I brought along some slides to help us as we work through this passage together. I suppose if I had a title for my message today, it would just be this little expression, "Then she shall live." Then she shall live. And I've taken that expression from verse 16 of Exodus 1 and the decree of Pharaoh. He says there at the end, "If it be a daughter, then she shall live." I want to talk a little bit today about the value of daughters, the value of sisters, young and old, in the plan of God. And especially in Exodus 1 and 2, the way that God used them in the deliverance of his people. Let's read a little bit together, starting at verse 1 of Exodus 1. "Now these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob." It gives us a bit of a list of names familiar to us. Let's go to verse 6. "And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And he said unto his people, Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses." Let's go down to verse 15. "The king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, When ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive." Verse 21. "And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. And there went a man of the house of Levi, and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein. And she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off, to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she'd opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, This is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, Go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, Because I drew him out of the water." May the Lord bless to us this reading from Scripture and the thoughts that I want to share together with you from it. Exodus is, of course, one of the great books of our Old Testament. It tells this story of how God delivered his people out of Israel. And we associate the book of Exodus, of course, with the character of Moses, this mighty man that God raised up to rescue his people, and the unique and marvelous circumstances that God worked in his life, right from the very time of his birth, all the way through to the time that he led them out across the Red Sea as God's called out people, as God's redeemed people, to be a people for God's own possession, to be a people who would worship him and among whom he could dwell. This little book of Exodus, it starts out with this word now. That's the very first word in the book in verse 1. That reminds us that this book isn't the start of a brand new story. It's actually the continuing on of the story of Genesis. It's, if you might say, volume 2 of a 5-volume set. In fact, if we were to go to the end of the book of Genesis, we would find that the very last word in the book of Genesis is the word Egypt. And of course, when we open the book of Exodus, it continues right on with the story that began in Genesis. It continues right on from Egypt. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel. That's a very interesting expression, isn't it, to start this book off with. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel. You might know from the book of Genesis that it's built around 10 times where we read this phrase, these are the generations of. These are the generations of the heavens and earth in chapter 2, of Adam, chapter 5, of Noah, chapter 6. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, chapter 10. These are the generations of Shem, chapter 11. These are the generations of Terah. These are the generations of Ishmael. These are the generations of Isaac. These are the generations of Esau. These are the generations of Jacob. And now when the book of Exodus starts, we start off with a very similar expression. Now these are the names of the children of Israel. And we won't have time to talk about it all this evening, but quite a few times, especially in the start of Exodus, we find these little phrases, these little expressions that are echoes of the book of Genesis. And it's just reminding us that this is continuing on the story of Genesis. Genesis talked about how God created the world and placed mankind in it, and how he called out a family, the family of Abraham, from it to this special calling. And now Exodus is going to tell us how that God who created a world, how it was that he took this family of Abraham and he formed a nation from it. And with that same sovereign power that he used in creating the world, he is going to exercise that power for the good of his people, to deliver them from bondage, to bring them to himself, to bring them through the wilderness and all the many trials and challenges along the way, and how he's going to be so faithful to them and bring them into the land and fulfill his promises to Abraham. We find from verse 5 that it was really a very small number of people who entered into Egypt, some 70 souls, 70 direct descendants of Jacob. I take it that this number represents those who are direct descendants of him, sons and grandsons and such, not including others who might have come along who were not his direct descendants, daughters-in-law, other extended members of the household and servants. But perhaps at most, maybe 100 or 200 people, something like that, came down into Egypt. We're not that many generations later, but we're going to learn later on in the book of Exodus that there are over 600,000 men of fighting age when they come out, perhaps 1 to 2 million people. That's a tremendous rate of growth, to go in with maybe 1 or 200 people and to come out a number of generations later, maybe 1 or 2 million people. How is it that the nation of Israel grew so tremendously? It's the supernatural hand of God blessing. Look at the language that we find in verse 7. The children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. 5 little expressions there: fruitful, increased abundantly, multiplied, waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Well, if you recognize some of those expressions, it's because those are the expressions from Genesis 1 about the creation of the world. Remember in verse 21 of Genesis 1, we read there that the waters brought forth abundantly. And here in Exodus 1, we read that the children of Israel increased abundantly. Remember in Genesis 1 and verse 22, we read that God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Fruitful, multiply, fill. And what do we read here in Exodus 1 and verse 7? the children of Israel were fruitful and multiplied, and the land was filled with them. And so again, we have this language from Genesis 1. It's reminding us that even though they're down in Egypt, God's eye is upon them. And the same God who worked so mightily in creation, in making this world, he has been working mightily behind the scenes for the good of his people. And he's going to continue to work mightily on their behalf. It all comes in fulfillment of the promise to Abraham, where he said that in blessing, I will bless thee, and in multiplying, I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand of the seashore. And you know, if the story just ended at verse 7, we would think that already the covenant of Abraham was being fulfilled. Already this great blessing was being seen. Already they were into the promises that God had given to Abraham so soon and so wonderfully and with very few bumps along the way. But we find that even though Israel's time in Egypt began with apparent blessing and abundance, it soon descended into bondage and suffering. From the standpoint of the house of Jacob, it was a wonderful thing that the land was filled with them. But in the eyes of the Egyptians, this overwhelming number of Jews was something that was potentially threatening to them. And in verse 8, we find that the situation changed entirely. We read in verse 8 that there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. It's possible that this wasn't just a new king, but actually a new dynasty. And if you've read something in the history of Egypt, you'll know that there were different dynasties that ruled over it. And in particular, there was one dynasty called the Hyksos kings. This was an invading dynasty. They came and they subjugated a large portion of the land of Egypt. And they ruled over the native Egyptians for more than 100 years. And the Egyptians chafed under their rule. After a little over a century, the Egyptians were able to rise up and throw off this dynasty and drive out these invaders. It's hard to say for certain, but perhaps this new king is the first king or one of the first kings after they've driven out these invading rulers. Perhaps it's the start of a new dynasty. And you can imagine after the invaders have been driven out that there would be a strong sentiment amongst the Egyptians against foreigners in their land and a great fear about being under this bondage, under the rule of foreigners again, or what might happen if another invading army came again. And so a new king arose who knew not Joseph. I don't think that this means that he didn't know who Joseph was. Remember, the Egyptians were meticulous record keepers. We have a lot of their records of their histories available to us today, even though much of it has been lost. I don't think it's that he didn't know who Joseph was, but maybe the thought is that he didn't acknowledge Joseph. He didn't care about Joseph. It meant nothing to him, the stories of what Joseph had done during the days of famine. In verse 9, he talks about the fear that the children of Israel are becoming more and mightier than them. Behold, he says, and the word, it emphasizes to us that this is an urgent problem, something that they should do something about. Look, he says, the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal with them. That's interesting language again in verse 10. Come, let us deal wisely with them. It seems again to me to echo language that we find back in Genesis. And I'm thinking now of the language of the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11. You remember that back then at Babel, that the people got together and they said, come, let us build a city and a tower. Or as it says in our authorized, go to, let us build a city and a tower. And there in Genesis, it was the language of opposition, rebellion against God and against his sovereign power and plan. And here we see Pharaoh maybe thinking he's acting in his own interests, But again, that great enemy of God moving him to rebel against the people of God, rebel against the plan of God. He says, come on, let us deal wisely with them. Let us multiply, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us. Pharaoh has a three-phase plan. And you can see that in verse 10, this plan is to prevent the children of Israel from multiplying. You see that in verse 10? Lest they multiply. Let's do this so that they don't multiply. But in verse 12, we're going to see then the sovereign plan of God. Despite him doing it, the more Israel multiplied and grew. And that's going to be a little bit of the story we're going to trace together this evening, how that God works out his sovereign will through the most unlikely of ways, through the most overlooked of people, despite the desires, despite the attacks of mighty and powerful enemies who are fighting against him. Pharaoh has a plan that is ultimately going to unfold in three phases. And here is phase one of his plan. Phase one of his plan is that they are going to, verse 11, afflict them. They're going to enslave the Jews. They're going to deprive them. They're going to put them under hard and cruel labor. They're going to make them build cities with inadequate supplies and inadequate resources and inadequate food. And they're going to try to break the spirit of this people. They're going to try to break down this people and gain the upper hand against the nation of Israel. But as we saw in verse 12, God's sovereign will supersedes all human plans. And it says there that the more that they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Verse 13 says that they made them serve with rigor, with hard bondage in mortar and in brick, in all manner of service in the field. All their service that they made them serve was with rigor. And we might say today, rather than with rigor, we might say with cruelty and with hardness. And yet the people of Israel continued to grow and multiply under this all. And so in verse 15, we see that Pharaoh turns to a second act of oppression. If cruelty and hard slavery won't work, he turns now to secret murder. He calls together the midwives. It seems in this case, just two, you might say, leaders of the midwives. Of course, you can imagine for the many tens or hundreds of thousands of Hebrew women that there would be many midwives possibly. And you'll see later on that these two ladies, Shiphrah and Puah, speak about the other midwives. And so maybe these two are the ones who are in charge of the other midwives, and Pharaoh calls them together. I find it very interesting that these two women are named Shiphrah and Puah. They are the only people who are given their proper names in chapters 1 and 2 until we come to Moses being named later on at the end, or sorry, at the end of the passage that we have read from. Pharaoh isn't named. Amram and Jochebed aren't even named. Miriam, if I'm right in taking it to be Miriam, she's not named. But these two women, Shiphrah and Puah, are named. These women would probably just be servants themselves, Hebrew servants themselves, people who would be often overlooked. They are the servants of the servants, you might say, and yet God takes notice of them. And what lovely names it is that they have. I understand that Shiphrah means beautiful one, and the name Puah refers to a fragrant blossom. If we were to turn to the book of Ezekiel 16, we would get an idea of the midwife's regular duties beyond delivering the baby. It speaks there about cutting the cord and washing the baby, rubbing the baby with salt and swaddling it. And now Pharaoh wants to add one more duty to their regular duties. And that duty is, when the baby is born, to pay heed to the sex of the baby. And if it is a son, to seemingly quietly and kill the baby and pretend the baby is stillborn. But if it is a daughter, then to let her live. A horrific plan. Pharaoh suggesting that they should do this secretly when they see the baby being delivered. And if they were to follow along with the plan, perhaps many a Hebrew mother would just think that her baby was stillborn. Look at the language. It doesn't say, if it's a boy, ye shall kill him, and if it's a girl, she shall live. But it says, if it's a son, ye shall kill him, and if it's a daughter, she shall live. And the very language recorded here points to the personal anguish that this plan would bring to the families of Israel. These weren't just boys and girls, just nameless ones being put to death. These were sons and daughters. These were the hopes of families that were being born. These were the heirs, firstborn, some of them, that Pharaoh was willing to put to death in pursuit of his wicked cause. And it's from this little verse that I have taken the title of my message today, "Then She Shall Live." If it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. Who was it who said that? It's Pharaoh who said that. Pharaoh, we're very familiar with the picture that I have up on the screen, a very famous picture, one of the headdresses of one of the pharaohs. Have you ever noticed what it is that's up at the top on the forehead of the pharaoh there? Why, there are two creatures there. And one of those creatures is a serpent. It reminds us of Genesis 3, doesn't it? And the serpents, the prophecy that was told there, that the serpent would try to strike out at the promised deliverer, would try to strike out at him to try to destroy him if he could. And here we see in Exodus that Satan is working through Pharaoh. It is as though that serpent is striking out at the hope of the deliverer among God's people. You know, if we were to go all the way to the end of Revelation 12, what would we find there? We would find that same one, that same wicked one, the devil, portrayed there not as a serpent, but there as a dragon. And what is it that dragon is doing? Revelation 12 and verse 4, "The dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born." And so right from Genesis to Revelation, we see this portrait of Satan, the serpent, the dragon, wanting to strike out and destroy the godly seed because he wants to destroy the promised deliverer who is coming to redeem his people. We see it here in Exodus 2 with Pharaoh ordering the deaths of little boys. We see it in Matthew chapter 2 with Herod trying to kill all the little baby boys in that area of Judea in order to destroy the Messiah. Pharaoh has tasked these two women with this task of killing the baby boys, and he assumes that they'll do his wicked work for him. But why was it then that I picked this one little expression? If it be a daughter, then she shall live. Why was it that Pharaoh was only interested in having the sons slain? Why was it that he only issued a command to have the boys slain? He says he was quite happy for the daughters to live. Pharaoh assumes that if there is any threat that comes from the nation of Israel, It's going to come through the sons. It's going to come through the men. Those will be the big, mighty men. Those will be the soldiers. Those will be the ones who might pose a threat someday. And he assumes that the daughters will never be any challenge to his plans. He assumes that they will just intermarry, perhaps, with the Egyptian men, that they will go along with whatever it is that he has planned. And so he utterly overlooks altogether the daughters of the people of Israel. If it's a son, that's a danger, and he must be done away with. But if it's a daughter, she shall live. And Exodus 1 and 2 are recorded in such a way to point out how very wrong Pharaoh was. Yes, God is going to deliver his people through Moses. But in Exodus chapter 1 and 2, we're going to read about five women. God is going to use these five women to bring Moses into the world, to safeguard him, and to subvert the plan of Satan and of Pharaoh, and to ultimately bring about the deliverance of his people. Pharaoh was saying that it was the sons that mattered, and that the little girls and the wives and the mothers, they weren't as significant. But God is saying through the narrative of Exodus 1 and 2, yes, little girls, yes, young women, yes, mothers, yes, older single women, yes, the daughters of the nation, even the daughters of Egypt, they do matter. And they're absolutely key to my redemption plan. God is saying, I'm going to use them to overthrow a mighty kingdom. And so it is today. It might be possible for many to overlook the often quiet roles that our sisters take in the home, in the assembly, in the world, in the neighborhood. And one might think that God's plan is worked out through those who are outwardly more conspicuous, that is worked out through those who are preaching, those who are the public face of the assembly, those who are the heads of their homes, maybe worked out through the great and mighty businessmen of the business world, the leaders of organizations, Christian and otherwise. Exodus 1 and 2 wants to remind us that God's plan of redemption is just as mightily brought about through his daughters as through his sons. And the assembly itself and the home flourishes just as much through the work that he does in and through our sisters, as through the work that he does in and through the brothers. And so let's take a look briefly together at these five women and how God used them in the deliverance of his people. So the first two I want to talk about are, of course, these two women, Shiphrah and Puah. I want to think a little bit together about their courage. We read in verse 17, but the midwives feared God. Look at the way that this is put together. Verse 15, the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives. Here's this man, the leader of one of the mightiest empires of his day. His word gave life and his word took life. His word was unopposed in its judgments. Whatever he said was what must be obeyed. Verse 15, the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives. And you can imagine how a servant might tremble to hear the words of the king. And yet, what do we read in verse 17? But the midwives feared God. The king of Egypt spoke, and in human terms, he seemed to have absolute power of life and death. But the midwives feared God, and they knew that he truly had power over their life and death. Where did Shiphrah and Puah, these two humble servants, get such courage to resist the king. It came from their fear. No, not their fear of the king, their fear of God. These servants could dare to go against the mighty king of Egypt because they had their eyes on a mightier king, the king of heaven, God Almighty himself. And notice that it's emphasized for us twice, verse 17, but the midwives feared God. Verse 21, because the midwives feared God. The question I have for myself and for you, especially for others who are a father or a mother, a parent like myself, is whom do you fear? We read here, the midwives feared God and did not, as the king of Egypt commanded them. And we are being told every day, commanded every day, how we should live our lives. And there's tremendous cultural and sometimes even governmental pressure being brought on us to conduct our lives and the lives of our family and those under our care in ways that would compromise the teaching of the Word of God. Sometimes you and I are called on to go against those pressures. And maybe soon we'll be called on to even go against governmental laws if they are opposed to God and his people and his word. We are commanded to be subject to the rulers that God has placed over us. And yet we must also heed what we read in Acts, that if they come into conflict, we must obey God rather than men. And the secret to it all is having a right and proper fear of God. Could it be said of you, as it was said of these midwives, she feared God, and therefore she did not? You know, they didn't make a big scene about what it was that they were doing. There wasn't any sort of public protest or anything against the Pharaoh. They just quietly worked to save the lives of the Hebrew children. We read that the Hebrew women delivered their babies quickly. That's what the midwife said. And maybe the midwives, recognizing this as an opportunity, also made sure that they weren't too quick to come to the home where a baby was being delivered. Maybe they intentionally began showing up a little late. Pharaoh had asked them to quietly and secretly kill, but instead they quietly and secretly saved lives because they feared God. Verse 18, Pharaoh was greatly displeased with them. You can almost hear the disdain in his voice. Why have ye done this thing? What are you doing? Pharaoh was greatly displeased with them. And yet, in verse 20, we discover that God delighted in them. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives. God delighted in their simple quiet, courage, their acts of faith. God delighted in them because they delighted in what God delights in, little children. Now look at the language in verse 21. It came to pass because the midwives feared God that God made them houses. He gave them homes and households. I think this word would imply he gave them children and families. Pharaoh doesn't value the Hebrew children. He's trying to destroy them. But God does value children. And Psalm 127 reminds us that children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. And this God who delights in children, he rewards these two women by giving them children, by giving them households and family. This is the same blessing in the same language that later King David would receive. And so they receive, as it were, you might say, the royal blessing of the Old Testament. God gave them households. Yes, God blessed them with children at a time when having children was dangerous. This doesn't seem like a time where you might necessarily think having children would be a blessing. And yet, it was a blessing for those who feared God. And for you and I, oh, you know, the coming of a, a baby, it brings with it some uncertainty sometimes. Sometimes we wonder about this world that we are bringing them into and bringing them up in. And yet children are a blessing from God. When he gives us that blessing, he will give us the grace, the courage, and the wisdom to see that as a blessing and to raise them in a way that honors him, to enjoy and profit from this great blessing of God. Sometimes raising a child in this world doesn't feel very brave. It sometimes feels very difficult. Sometimes, to use a modern expression, it seems a little messy and frustrating. It takes courage to bring children into the world and raise them up for God. And God sees and honors the courage of mothers and fathers and all those who would seek to honor him in the raising and caring for children. Secondly, I want to think in chapter 2 of Jochebed and her faith. And here I've taken this from Hebrews 11, where we read that it was by faith that Moses' parents hid him for 3 months. Her name isn't given to us here. She is just called the woman. But later on, we find that her name is Jochebed. And what a name Jochebed is, that name means the glory of Jehovah. Or perhaps Jehovah is her glory. She's a Levite who married within her tribe to another Levite named Amram. She has 2 children already. She has a son, Aaron, and we know that he would be about 3 years of age at this time from Exodus 7. And since Aaron is still alive, that suggests that Pharaoh's decree must have still been quite recent by the time we get to chapter 2. Miriam's a bit older, hard to say exactly how old, but maybe somewhere between 7 and 12 years of age. She's old enough to watch the basket, but still young enough that she hasn't been put to labor out in the fields. And so this son and daughter of Levi from this tribe that will later be set apart and in a special way sanctified to the service of God, this son and daughter of Levi, Amram and Jochebed, they marry, and in a little while, Jochebed conceives, and she is expecting a son. And we look forward to the birth of a child. A pregnancy is a time of great joy for us, but you can imagine maybe for Jochebed and other mothers at this time, it would be a time of some fear. What if it's a boy? Imagine waiting through the months of a pregnancy, 6 months or maybe 9 months, whenever one came to recognize that they were expecting a child. Imagine going month after month and maybe hoping it wasn't a boy. How the birth of a son, that would normally be the hope and an occasion of joy for a Hebrew household, especially one that didn't have any children. Yet now it would perhaps be for many a thought of terror. In Hebrews 11, verse 23, though, what is it that we read about Moses' parents? I'll just turn there and read it to you. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Here we have the other side of things from chapter 1. In chapter 1, the midwives feared God. Chapter 2, Jochebed did not fear the king. She was a woman of faith. And when her baby was born, she hid that baby. She knew she couldn't do it forever. When a baby's very young, as so many of you will know, a baby sleeps much of the time, and even its cries, especially in the early days, are very quiet. And often when the little baby, the newborn, begins to cry, often it can be quieted by nursing. It will soon quieten down and maybe fall asleep again. She sees that this baby is a gift from God. And there's something, she feels special about this child. Her heart's drawn to it. And so she hides him. Did she have a plan for the future? A year, 2 years down the road? Maybe not. But she obeyed God today. And that's really all that faith calls us for, isn't it? Not to not to sort out everything about next year and the next decade, but what about today? To obey God today and trust him about tomorrow. Well, after 3 months had gone, verse 2, all of a sudden she realized that she couldn't hide him in the home anymore. You know, as any young parents know, or those who've been young parents, after a few months, the baby's cry can be quite piercing, not easily hidden or silenced, not so easily quieted. And now what's she going to do? But notice that Jochebed's faith wasn't idle during that time. Faith to her didn't mean just doing nothing and seeing what happened. It was an act of faith. During those safe early months, she was busy, either finding or possibly weaving a basket and applying slime and pitch to it. If she wove that basket, that would be something that would take a lot of time. And you could imagine her there in the home, quietly laboring away. We don't know when God put this thought on her heart, this idea in her mind, but there she is quietly laboring away for her children's future safety. And God sees, as he sees the quiet labors of many a mother, for the good of her children, for their spiritual safety in days to come. No one else might see it, but he sees it. She makes this ark. It's not an open basket, as you sometimes see portrayed in the children's storybook. We read in verse 6 that when the basket was fetched, or I should rather say the ark, that it had to be opened. And so it's some sort of an enclosed reed ark, and she lays it in the along the river's edge, maybe in an inlet or bay off to the side of the river, out of the current. Maybe her thought was that down in the water, it would be away from the paths where the soldiers might typically walk and hear if there was a little bit of noise. And being outdoors, there are sounds, of course, of birds and different creatures. And there would be the noise of the water lapping against the seashore that might cover some of the little sounds the baby might make. And being along the water's edge, she would be able to retrieve that basket to nurse the baby as a young baby like that might need from time to time. I don't know if her thought was to just put the baby in and see what would happen and sort of leave the baby there, or whether maybe her thought was that just during certain times of the day when maybe the soldiers would come looking, that during those times she thought it was most likely he would be discovered, that she would put him down there. I don't know if what follows in chapter 2 came from the first time she put him down by the river's edge, or if this was something that she had been doing a number of days at that time. But this was anyways what was on her heart to do. It doesn't seem like much of a plan, does it? Putting a little baby, a few months old, in a basket on the edge of the river. Think about all the things that could go wrong. The baby could become dehydrated in the hot Egyptian sun. The basket might capsize and the baby would drown. And of course, we think of the Nile. We think of the crocodiles that are there. Or maybe some Egyptians would come across it. Oh, there'd be so many things that might worry a mother's heart. But Hebrews 11 says she did it by faith, trusting God to preserve it. In a sense, fearless in faith before God. Not that there weren't any concerns on her hearts, but trusting God to keep her children safe. It's only faith, dear sister, that can give you courage when you think about children and grandchildren and raising them for God. Only faith. There's a myriad of things that one might worry about that could go wrong on a future day. We leave tomorrow with God, and we join Jochebed, and by faith, we seek to honor him. We work quietly in faith for that future day, and we trust God for it. But I want to think now about Miriam. Now, the sister's unnamed here in Exodus 2, but I'm going to assume that it's Miriam. That's the only older sister of Moses that we know about. So we've thought about the midwife's courage and Jochebed's faith. I want to think for a few minutes about Miriam's faithfulness. Again, I suggested she's maybe somewhere between 7 and 12 years of age, young enough to still be living a girl's life, not expected to be out working in the fields or domestically, but old enough to be able to converse wisely even with a princess. What do we find that Moses' sister is doing? She's watching the basket in verse 4. Did her mother Jochebed tell her to do this? We don't know. Or was it just sisterly care? I've seen in our own home how older sisters can have a very tender care for their younger siblings. And we're not told how long she kept watch. Was it just during this day? Or, as I've suggested, had she maybe done this other days before? We don't know. But she was faithful in watching over this little basket. Not only was she faithful, but she was very wise. Because when the daughter of Pharaoh comes along and sees this little baby in this basket, in this ark, maybe Miriam recognizes a hint of compassion in the princess's eyes. I don't know. Was it just Miriam's quick thinking and the leading of the Spirit of God that led her to suggest her mom as a nursemaid? It seems to me unlikely that Jochebed could have predicted that Pharaoh's daughter would come and find Moses in the ark. It seems unlikely to me that Jochebed could have foreseen this and instructed Miriam what to do. Why would she plan for her son to be found by Pharaoh's daughter, by someone from the very family that was plotting to destroy him? And how could she know that the princess would come and bathe then and there and come at that moment? It seems to me that God gave special wisdom to this faithful young girl. God gave her courage to, it would take remarkable courage for a little slave girl to speak up to a princess. Well, speaking about the princess, I want to think for a minute about Pharaoh's daughter. We thought about the midwife's courage, Jochebed's faith, Miriam's faithfulness, and now Pharaoh's daughter and her compassion. We read in chapter 2 and verse 6, she had compassion on him. This young princess was probably one of many daughters. We know that some of the pharaohs had at least 60 different daughters. She came down this day, verse 5, just expecting to wash herself along the river. And coming down is the right word for it. The Nile flooded pretty much every year, and the homes and dwellings were built up and away from the river. And so she came down there to bathe. Egyptians held the river to be somewhat sacred, and so maybe that would be what would bring her down here to bathe and not somewhere within the palace. And we see in verse 5, as she goes down to bathe, and maybe her maids, who are maybe sort of guarding her, attending to her, they're possibly up on the shore and she's down in the water. And down in the water, she is able to see from that vantage point the ark among the reeds. It seems like the worst possible outcome. Surely, this is the worst possible person to find the ark. Pharaoh's own daughter, surely she'll kill him. And yet, even when things seem to be falling apart, you must always remember that God is sovereign. She sends a maid to fetch it. There's another unnamed young woman that haven't spoken about tonight that God is using in his plan. She opens it in verse 6. She sees the child. And just then, the baby weeps. I think of the words of Arnold Adams, "A baby's tears changed the destiny of nations." And those tears drew out the compassion in her heart. Right away, she recognizes that this child is a Hebrew, maybe from the swaddling garments that were around it, maybe from the physical features of the baby, maybe from the fact that it's down here in this ark along the river's edge. Why would someone put a baby there if they didn't have to? She recognizes this child as a Hebrew, the ones that her father hates, the ones that her father is seeking to destroy, but her love and compassion, it reaches out beyond ethnic and social barriers. And maybe part of the reason for her affection is she realizes this baby is condemned to death. She has compassion on this baby, and she takes personal responsibility for it. She could have passed the baby on to her maid, either to kill or to keep, but she takes him for herself. Maybe she thinks, I'll raise him as an Egyptian, and then it won't matter that I've saved him alive, and notice her courage as well. She's willing to quietly go against her father's wicked wishes. At that time, Miriam comes and offers to call a Hebrew nurse for her. It wouldn't seem unusual, I don't think. Remember that many Hebrew mothers had had their babies put to death, and so it would be natural to expect that there would be many Hebrew mothers capable of nursing a newborn. And Pharaoh's daughter says, "Go," and Miriam goes and brings Jochebed. And Pharaoh's daughter gives Moses unto Moses' own mother and offers to pay her to raise her own son. Jochebed was the only Hebrew mother who could carry her son about openly in Goshen. No one could harm him. He was protected and paid, and his raising was paid for by the same royal house that had sought to destroy him. And yet it wasn't the princess who made him safe, but God. Moses had been just as safe floating down the river in the hand of God as he now was in Pharaoh's own house. You see, it's not circumstances that make us and our children safe, but God and his divine sovereignty. He makes us safe and uses circumstances to do so. I often wonder where this princess ended up. Was she eventually among the redeemed? No one knows, but God used her compassion to save his people. If I could just come back for a moment again to Jochebed and her faith. The time would come, Moses possibly only 3 or 4 years old, and Jochebed would have to let him go again. Not to the river this time in a little ark floating by the edge, but let him go to Pharaoh's house. And the only thing that she had to give to him, to send him away with, is the presence of the Lord and the truth she had taught him. He was going to be raised in all the learning of the Egyptians and all the influence of Pharaoh's house. And she had to trust him to those circumstances, to the sovereign hand of God, and to what she had instilled with him as a boy by faith. Maybe the most difficult time for a mother and even for a father is when we have to take that little child for whom we have woven a fabric of faith into their lives and let them go out into this world, trusting them to God and to the little things we have sought to weave into their lives in obedience to God. These women were all so different. They were all from different ages. Miriam, a little girl. Jochebed, a mother. Pharaoh's daughter, a young woman. Maybe the midwives, older, single women. They all had different statuses. Jochebed was a slave. Shiphrah and Puah were midwives. Pharaoh's daughter was a princess, and Miriam was a sister. They all worked in different places. The midwives in their workplace, Jochebed in her home, Miriam outside, and the princess in the palace. And yet they were all used by God to deliver his people. And God today is using young girls, young women, mothers, wives, older women, grandmothers, ones from all different stages of life, from all different walks of life, in all different spheres of life, for the good of his people, for the salvation of souls, for the glory of his names. Of course, there are no caveats with God, but you'll know what I mean if I say that without these women, Moses would never have lived to arise as God's great deliverer of his people. They had just as much part in God delivering his people as Moses in all his prominence did. But if I might come back in closing, just to this thought of the ark. This ark. We read there in verse 3, Jochebed took for him an ark. She made an ark for him. Did you know that this Hebrew word only occurs one other time in our Bibles? It's the word that's used for Noah's ark. Only two arks like this in Scripture. Moses' ark and Noah's ark. Now tell me, which ark was more important in God's plan? One ark was very big and impressive. Wow, look at what Noah built. Think of all the time he spent building it. Hundreds of thousands of people, I read, have gone down to visit this model of the ark, this scale model of this ark in the United States. And all the ones I know who've gone down there and come back, they marvel at it. And they talk about what a tremendous thing it is to see this big full-scale ark and all the things that they saw inside of it. But where's the model of Jochebed's ark that visitors flock to? Where's the Jochebed's ark museum? Where are the people impressed by what Jochebed built? Somehow it seems a lot less significant. Just a little ark, not made of gopher wood, but made of reeds. Yet when we come to Hebrews 11, we find Jochebed right there alongside Noah in Faith's Hall of Fame. Brothers and sisters, but especially dear sisters, especially young mothers, I hope you feel encouraged in your spirit tonight that there's a tremendous glory in what you're doing. It might seem very small, like Jochebed's ark, in comparison to the great things that others seem to be doing, like Noah's ark. None of these dear women could have imagined the scope of what God was accomplishing through their actions. Their small acts of service and obedience and faith were saving a nation. Outwardly, their actions seemed insignificant. Each of them was just loving and trying to care for a little child. But through them, God did something very significant. He delivered a nation. God used the courage of the midwives, the faith of Jochebed, the faithfulness of Miriam, and the compassion of Pharaoh's daughter for the salvation of his people. And he's working out the same thing through your faith, your courage, your compassion, your faithfulness as well. When you have opportunity next to gather together, look at all the children around you. Don't overlook them. They're precious gifts and blessings from God. And would you and I love and care for those children in faith with the love and care of God? We are doing something that is great in God's eyes and that will not go unrewarded. You know, loving and caring for children is something we all can do. It's something that Christ did. It delights God, and he uses it to change the world. God works great things through the smallest of means. A little baby floating in an ark of reeds by the side of the river will deliver a nation from slavery. And one day, a little baby in a manger under the watchful eyes of a poor mother and father will deliver the world from sin's bondage. And who knows what God is working through the little ones in your life and mine, through the little details of your life and mind, for his glory and for the everlasting well-being of his people. So may these thoughts encourage us as we seek to live for him. Thank you.